Hello, everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of Troublemakers, a podcast by MakerMag, where we interview founders and creators redefining what it means to be an entrepreneur today. Many thanks to our sponsor, Blockstack, for making this podcast possible. Blockstack provides makers with a stack of layers so people who use their apps truly own their data, identity, content, and connections. Give it a try for free at blockstack.org/makermag. That's blockstack.org/makermag. I'm Anne-Laure, the founder of MakerMag, and our guest today is Kate Kendall. Kate, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cool. So before we start chatting about your projects and your vision about indie entrepreneurship, could you maybe introduce yourself for everyone listening? Like, how did you get started with entrepreneurship?
Yeah, sure. So I never really woke up or was a kid that had like a lemonade stand that, you know, was like, I'm going to be Richard Branson or an entrepreneur. Like I kind of felt that it didn't really speak to me when I was growing up. And then it was really only when I started, I was working in magazine publishing. And then I started kind of on Twitter in like 2008 and met like other engineers and developers and stuff like that. And they were traveling the world. And I found that it was just like really inspiring. So it was kind of like out of desire to create a flexible lifestyle that I started creating my own projects. And that was really around 2009. And so it kind of grew out of the ability to create freedom. And then it started like, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. And the other thing is I felt like a full-time 9-to-5 in office work just really wasn't designed for me. And there weren't really many options back then. So it was kind of either you work for yourself or you create your own business or you get a job. And I remember when I used to work in offices, you know, I'd get there and at 8:30 or whatever, and then people would kind of make toast and just take all these breaks. And I was like, this is so not focused on productivity. I'd rather be doing other stuff and making the most of my time. So it kind of grew out of that really, rather than, I wanted to be an entrepreneur.
That's awesome. And so from this time to today, what happened? What are your main projects at the moment?
Yeah. So, and then a quick kind of fill in. So my first company was The Fetch. And so that was a kind of crowdfunded event guide for professional events, tech, you know, creative design type thing. And then from there, I created Cloud Peeps, and that was a more of a traditional, I raised $1 million. I was in New York and San Francisco, and that's a marketplace for freelancers or indie professionals, as I call them. And then today, I'm still working on Cloud Peeps, but I created a company called Indie Labs, which is all about championing what I call the indie way. And under that, there sits Addo Accelerator, which is an accelerator for female founders that helps them create MVPs, get to product market fit with or without code. And so it's really, it's non-equity based. So it's offering alternatives on that. And then now IndieConf. And IndieConf is similar to, say, MicroConf in the US or FemtoConf in Europe. It's really a conference that celebrates everything to do with indie companies, makers, profitability-focused founders, self-funded, bootstrappers, etc.
Nice. Okay, lots to unpack. So we met through Women Make, actually, and you've always been a champion of women entrepreneurs. So first, let's talk about Addo VC. So can you tell us a little bit more about it? What makes it different from other accelerators?
Yeah, so part of what I noticed with the accelerator market, and, you know, I really didn't want to kind of start an accelerator, but what I was noticing is that there's a lot of female founders kind of don't know how to code. So they get into these accelerators that will kind of be like, we'll give you money and then you give us that money and then we'll build your product. And they're fine, but I kind of find that at the end of the accelerator program, they might have a custom built MVP, but still no traction, not really, you know, proven methodology to find that product market fit. So there's a few out there like that. And there's quite a few accelerators that focus on literally like it's like 10 or 12 weeks of how to pitch. And then it results in a demo day where you ask for money. So instead of kind of figuring out how to serve your customers best or how to kind of refine your business model so you can scale, it's literally just teaching you how to pitch and pitch in a very public manner. Like when I actually raised money, I didn't actually raise money from public speaking. It was one-on-one coffees where you would establish trust and you'd share your ideas and your visions and things like that. So I kind of feel like a lot of traditional accelerators aren't setting up female founders for the best way to actually succeed. So Addo kind of came about because I was like, well, one, you don't necessarily need to always find like a technical co-founder. You don't always need to quit your job. You don't not have to have like a family. You can do all these things and start making and creating and earning money in a DIY sense and that indie sense. So I kind of say it's about creating independent, scalable and sustainable businesses. It is focused on tech startups still. It's not necessarily like consultancies or agencies or from that side of things, but it's really about giving women a toolkit and framework to create and then really maintain that freedom and independence long term.
Nice. And you mentioned the fact that lots of these female founders don't know how to code. So do you also help them find no code tools to build the MVP instead of hiring a technical person to help them?
Yeah, well, definitely, because I think there's a few things that founders tend to procrastinate on or kind of get distracted by. One is when they like initially started out, they sometimes think, oh, I need money. So they start talking to investors and they go down that pathway. The other thing, if they're non-technical, they kind of don't really give themselves permission to make until they find a developer. And then they get trapped in this cycle of trying to find a technical co-founder or like seek permission. Or, you know, a lot of accelerators, traditionally like YC, won't even accept a solo founder or a non-technical founder. So they kind of, it's this like what I'm encouraging is this independent, permissionless entrepreneurship where they can go and find these tools. And we do have a partnership with MakerPad, which I'm sure a lot of the audience would be familiar with now, where they can go on and learn how to like create a marketplace or clone like Airbnb, right, in like a day or so. So one of the beautiful things about the web is it's much easier to start a company now than it was when I was starting out like 10 or so years ago. So you pretty much don't need to custom build an Apple platform from day one. I'm not saying that you won't need that long term when you do hit scale, but you can pretty much get to a decent amount of revenue with no code tools or just a kind of bootstrap solution.
That totally makes sense. So basically, Indie Labs is for you kind of like this umbrella company, allowing you to champion the indie way through those different projects. So at OVC, the IndieConf, etc.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's kind of like a beta works. So and that's where like I want to micro invest. I've made a few like small investments, mostly through equity crowdfunding type rounds and platforms. But it's also where I advise. So it's kind of like that full stack laboratory where I can launch new products as well and assist. So instead of what I used to do, which is like start one company and then have a new operational entity and everything was like in an individual company like the Fetch and then Cloud Peeps, it's now like Indie Labs is a way that I can kind of rapidly prototype and help all under the one umbrella.
That's nice. I've done the same with my own company and I think it works pretty nicely.
Yep.
You actually, like, you know, beside all of the work you're doing through Indie Labs, you also often tweet about the damage that can be caused by kind of like the unicorn or nothing mindset or the growth at all costs, Silicon Valley approach to entrepreneurship. And I'd love to kind of understand what made you realize that, you know, this was wrong and that also that there was an alternative pathway to this.
Absolutely. So this is definitely reflected in my own personal journey, which is why I'm so passionate about it, because I started out and when I did my first company, The Fetch, that was more of an indie company. And really, it kind of felt like it wasn't taken seriously because I didn't raise money. And so people would be like, oh, you have a, you know, that's a nice little company kind of thing. And then you'd be reading startup press or like it was in those days, TechCrunch was really prevalent. So, you know, it was like the epitome of being a successful entrepreneur. It's kind of like brainwashing was to raise money. So When I started Cloud Peeps, I was like, okay, what do? Of course, you go raise money. So you get a bit of traction and then you raise. And this was kind of also around like the peak seed stage. So this was when a lot of companies were like raising on convertible notes. They were having capless like valuations. So it was just like the heyday 2014, 2015, there was lots of money around before we kind of got into more like the Series A crunch. But I really felt like, oh, what I do is I go raise money and then I hire people and then I work all the time. And it's kind of like this thing. And then, I raised $1 million and started building Cloud Peeps and started hiring all these people. And we were kind of doing the whole like Uber approach or like WeWork, where you see like you actually make a lot of revenue, but you're not that profitable. So you're just kind of like burning money, right? But you're still growing, but it's not focused on profitability. And then throughout that time as well, like San Francisco, where I was living, I was paying thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for a one bedroom apartment to be based there. Everything in the city was getting really unaffordable, and also like income inequality was great. So if you ever go to the Bay Area, you do see how the juxtaposition between the rich and the poor. And at that same time, there started to be like a lot of things happening in tech, like the shuttle buses with Google and other tech companies down in the Bay Area, and people were being like forced out of their apartments, and all the, it was like limited. There's limited like housing in the Bay Area. So tech kind of became something that I used to aspire and think it, we were doing really like ethical, like, you know, changing the world and having a positive impact. And then around me, I just saw a lot of companies that were kind of just not like, it was just about the money. It had become like another Wall Street, and I didn't really get into tech to do that. And then, you know, at the same time, I was just noticing that all these companies were going bust as well, a lot in the sharing economy and the on-demand economy. So a lot of these like cleaning startups and, you know, you get everything on demand, like massages. And so there's a lot of like boom and bust. And then I started reflecting on that, if that's something that I really want to be on. Like, do I want to be on that hamster wheel journey where it's just all or nothing? And, you know, it's, you've got to work all the time. And if you're not growing 20% month on month, you're failing. And then also as a female founder, I did encounter like a lot of comments like, oh, don't have kids or don't do this. And it just kind of made me reflect and go, I don't think this is sustainable for me as a person, this kind of life. And also these companies aren't even necessarily succeeding long term. So I started reaching out to makers. Like one of my advisors and investors, actually, Joel Gascoigne from Buffer. I spoke to a few people based all over the world that had done more of like this indie bootstrap approach, like Balsamic founder, like all these companies that you kind of hear of. They might have raised money and done an investor buyback, or they might be fully bootstrapped. And I started going, oh, wow, like this is how you can actually have a meaningful contribution that is servicing customers for the longer term. And it's not like churn and burn, and they have families and they seem to have lives and they're making money and they're focused on profitability. Like this makes sense. And so that was when I started to go, okay, like this is the indie way, and how do I get more on that pathway and out of the Silicon Valley growth at all costs way.
Amazing. So yeah, that's your personal journey. And you mentioned that you found, when you started reaching out, you know, to the founder of Buffer or of Balsamic and other people, you did find other founders that felt the same way. So do you feel like that the mindset is changing?
Absolutely. I feel like the power had kind of swung to VCs, and most of the startup cities and ecosystems around the world, if you look at the kind of average of the events and the accelerators and programs, it's all focused on like funding. And one of the things I loved about the early tech community, it was focused on making. It was a lot of like developers that were talking about what they'd built, and yeah, there were tools and they were like looking at creating just great ways to do things. And I think what's happening now with the maker movement, the indie movement, is there's that shift back. Like if you don't rely on VC, you can take that power back and create great businesses. And you often hear about stories where, you know, yes, you have companies that have raised like 20, 40 million, and they have hundreds of people, but they're not necessarily succeeding against like an indie maker. So I think the like level playing field, it has become better, and that you can now launch software, and as long as you have the right capability and the right product, you can kind of compete on scale. So I think that's super exciting. And I think there has been a massive shift back, and I think it will continue to shift as well as we see that the VC movement becomes a little bit less sustainable. You do hear about bubbles all the time, but I think things have to change. And there have been a lot of IPOs in the Valley this year, but there was like a bit of a drought there for a while where funds weren't being returned, so that unit economics weren't that compatible. But I think that longer term, I want to kind of really see and champion more of the indie way and the maker movement. And I'm not opposed to capital. I think things like Earnest Capital, Tiny Seed, and Indie VC, and a few of these, there's one in Australia, Mudbrick Capital, are fantastic. I just think that you should raise capital in a mindful way and make sure that you have control and you're doing it on your terms and you're not just doing it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, totally agree. And it's great that there's so many options nowadays.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a couple of companies, but do you have any others? What are some of your favorite companies that are championing the indie way nowadays?
Yeah, well, I've mentioned Indie VC, and I must give credit because I think Bryce and Indie VC were really big champions, because Bryce's background as well with traditional capital, like him coming out there and having Indie VC, has really shown like legitimized the movement, because he has a reputation like in VC already. And I think they've really thoughtfully approached how they like proceed with investment and the optionality that's in there. So Indie VC, I think everyone should check out. Unfortunately, a lot of the capital, and I know you're not based in the States, but a lot of like the early stage has been based around the US. So it's exciting to see in Australia now that there is one called Mudbrick, as I mentioned, that literally just launched, that is looking at that. And I think Earnest and Tiny Seed, I think they're approaching it more globally minded. So founders, if you don't have like a US Delaware C Corp, you know, you can still get funding. Because I think part of the indie movement that I really like as well is the global approach to it. So when I was in Australia a decade ago, there really was no tech maker, like there wasn't much of a community, there wasn't a capital community. So going to Silicon Valley was all that you did, like you, there weren't really any options. And now I think the future of tech is fully distributed, and people who are based all over and not just in capital cities even. Like now I live in the country, in Australia. So I love the companies and the tools and the resources that are focused on global indie founders. I think that's the future.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's actually interesting how lots of companies, especially bootstrap ones, make it a conscious choice not to incorporate or base themselves out of San Francisco, right?
Yeah, totally. It's just so like salaries, you're competing with people who are making $500,000 or more at like these big tech companies. And yes, you can offer remote, you can kind of offer a better culture and all this kind of stuff. But if you actually, you know, fully look globally and create a better way to do things, like it's not, you're not competing directly. But I think if you try and build a company in the Bay Area, and, you know, it's great if you have like an office there, like a sales or marketing, or one of the founders might be based there. But I think for all of our hires now, there's just no point really to be there, because the cost of living is even just so great. I just don't think it allows people to get ahead. And there's lots of other places that people can be based now. And I think, you know, internet, we are workers on the internet, so we should be practicing what we preach with remote.
What about you, by the way? You've lived in San Francisco. You're in Melbourne now. On your website, you mentioned that both Melbourne and San Francisco are home for you.
Yeah, so I was based in San Francisco and New York for like 7 years. And then I was going back to San Francisco quite frequently. But we actually now have a house that's about an hour on the train from Melbourne. So we've been based more at the house. We actually were nomads as well, like before we were in the US.
That's amazing. Like,
yeah, about 2010, or probably, yeah, 2010, 2011, 2012. full-time nomads, like living on Airbnb, off Airbnbs, I should say. And that was great. And it was really good to, you know, we'd go to Bali, we'd be going all over. So early nomad community. But then I also think that you kind of hit a certain, not age, because I don't think it's necessarily to do with age, but like where having routine, creating a bit of more of a solid foundation. If you are having family, like you do need these kind of roots put down more. So, yeah, that's why we've kind of decided to be based in one place more so. And I'm British Australian, so my husband Matt's Australian. So Australia is a great place for us to be based at this point in time.
Nice. And in terms of running your company and networking, etc., do you miss San Francisco? Mm. Is there anything that you feel like would be easier to do if you were there?
Well, I think that one of the beautiful things about the indie movement is that if you remove the need to seek investment continually, you kind of almost make the Bay Area redundant, because it's fantastic. It's the best place to be if you want to raise capital on competitive terms, because it's the most experienced market, it's the most progressive market, and that's where the kind of VC leaders are still. And I've raised money from angels in Australia and New York and the Bay Area. And the Bay Area by far is the most sophisticated market for capital. But if you don't need to like raise money, you can kind of like delete all the networking and all the kind of reputation building that you need to have there. So in some ways, because I've gone more indie approach, I find like most of my networking actually happens online now. And even with IndieConf, we will be getting together. But there's actually a lot of incredible makers and founders and profitable companies that are doing serious annual revenue that are based in Australia and all over. So I think it's about finding that community. And part of like the reason, you know, it's like, do you work to live or live to work? And for me, I want to kind of really be focused on profitability and output, so in productivity. So I think a lot of the, you know, distractions of networking events and trying to build your profile all the time, or getting press to signal to investors that your company is worthy, and all of the scene, what I call like the startup scene, becomes really less important when you're on the indie path. Because on the indie path, you like, you care about your customers and you care about making your product better. And as long as you satisfy your customer needs and you can kind of get that deal flow coming in, or the sales, that's the most important thing. The other thing about being in the scene and trying to kind of be relevant or all that other stuff, or even stay in touch with what everyone else is doing, like part of the barrier is it's a bit like an echo chamber. So everyone will talk about things. So, you know, it'll be like, drones are popular, then it was like crypto and AI. So it's like you kind of end up just being focused on what's right in front of you. And I think moving away has made me kind of see like a bigger picture, be a lot more calm, like calmer about the future and building something for the longer term, and not getting caught up in what everyone else is doing. And I think that really allows you to create from a deeper place. And I tend to use the word like legacy versus thirsty, because like if you think about when you say like, oh, someone's thirsty, like you're thirsty for attention or you're thirsty for whatever, like I'm kind of over being thirsty for all that kind of stuff. And I'd much rather be working on a legacy. And a legacy, you know, I think when we're on our deathbeds, like what are we going to look back and be proud of? And I want to be proud of like the relationships I have and the contributions I've made. I'm probably going to be less inclined to be like, oh, I was a hotshot founder that raised, you know, 100 million and created this company that IPO'd. Like that might be great, but it's not going to be the thing that I look back on and go, wow, like that was it. So I want to, you know, focus more on legacy than thirstiness.
I agree. Thinking this way definitely allows you to make decisions for the longer term and thinking in a more sustainable way. So yeah, that's great. So between Indie Labs, the IndieConf, and AtoVC, you just talked about the importance of being calm and working in a sustainable way, but you do seem to keep super busy. So do you have any secrets to be productive while keeping your sanity?
Well, I think that I remember when I wanted to actually do Indie Labs, I spoke to a few people. And because I had been like just fully focused on Cloud Peeps for like 4 years or so, people like, oh no, that's really confusing. You know, you should only have like one thing that you promote. And there's this whole like notion of focus in the Bay Area as well, where it's like, you have to focus, and everyone like talks about only focusing on one thing, and that's the key to success. And I know some people, that's how they want to be, like that it's about, you know, they're working on one thing and they really want to hyper focus on that. For me, I think I've always found better flow and stimulation by following my like natural creativity and energy and passion around projects. I'm also like someone who commits to something and kind of will do it year after year. So a lot of the projects I start, I will be working on for like, you know, 4 or 5 plus years. Like it's, I think that's important as well. But sometimes you've just got to kind of go, okay, I'm not going to listen to what other people are saying. I'm just going to do this because I see a market need. I see like the trend is there. I see there's an opportunity. So a lot of it's kind of a natural response to a problem I've had. And I don't really overthink it too much. And I think that's why we all come together as makers. Like we actually like making. So I think you've just got to kind of give yourself permission to make and not care too much about storytelling at the start. So I think if people were like, how's this going to look, or how do I position this, or who do I market it to, all that kind of stuff, just start making and doing. I think just focus on the, you know, each step. Don't think, overthink things. Like sometimes I've started things and they're very, very small to begin with. So it might be just like, I'm going to create a website, like, you know, you can easily put something up in Squarespace and like an evening and then, you know, share it, see what people think about that. So yeah, just focus on doing. And this is what I've also learned advising companies in Addo, is that I think a lot of founders talk themselves out of things as a way of procrastination, because it's an emotional journey too. So they often, you know, will have an idea and then they'll start thinking and thinking and thinking about the idea, and then they'll almost like talk themselves out of an idea, and then they'll be like, okay, I'm going to pivot to do this. And they keep kind of like pivoting without progress. And I'm just like, just do some things, like just set a task list and just go through it and just see where you get, because you won't know if you have clarity until you actually do these things. So that's like a huge thing. And again, take advice on board, but don't get too distracted by what other people are saying, because if you listen to everyone, you'll end up not listening to yourself. And I think out of this whole conversation, that is something that I also learned, that, you know, if you kind of don't really get clear on your own constitution, like who you are and what you stand for and what you believe in, it's really hard to stay the course as an entrepreneur. So you kind of need to get quiet and really find out and discover who you are and what you stand for. And I think you can make from a much better place than if you're kind of just looking for something. So that's been a huge thing as well. Just kind of, it's almost like unlearning and unprogramming. And that's why I say the indie path, because it's doing stuff on your own terms and really realizing why you're doing that. And it's so important, because you need obviously vision. And if you're kind of, again, when I'm advising, it's almost like if you don't have an opinion or you don't have a vision and you don't really know why you're creating something, other people can sense that. So as Simon Sinek, I think, or Sundook says, start with why. So you've really got to understand like why you're actually doing this and how does it relate back to you.
Amazing. Well, that sounds like a great final takeaway to me. So thank you so much, Kate, for being with us today and for sharing everything about your projects and your vision. Can't wait for everyone to listen to this. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for Maker Mag. I think it's a really important contribution to the ecosystem as well. So thanks for having me on the podcast.